So in the ECRIS workshop, we started from a case which in fact was a burglary against two companies with an harm of 30,000 euros. And the first information we had is that there were fingerprints and DNA found on the place of the facts. And we wondered first how would the French police, because it was a fact committed in Calais in France, how would the French police obtain information about the identification and the fingerprints which had been found on the place. Some people in the group answered that maybe there must be police tools for that. We also said that in our opinion there is no international tool for fingerprints, so there was no solution about that that topic, about the element. There was the fact is that there were results of fingerprints and DNA. They showed that there were four persons found: one Tunisian national, Mohamed Khalid, born in Redeyef, living in Belgium, and also he lived in Spain and Germany. Second person found via the fingerprints and the DNA was a Slovenian national, living in, we don't know where in fact, but born in Moscow. A third person, an Italian national, Mario Rossi, born in Roma and also now under an alias, Tino Rossi. And finally, a French national, Jean Martin, born in Nancy. So we wondered how it's possible to use ECRIS for each of them, of the four persons found via the fingerprints. Concerning the Tunisian, because it's a third country national, as we mentioned, as we saw this morning, would it be useful to ask for information to every member state, maybe? Because as we saw this morning, there is no centralization for the convictions for third country nationals. So some people in the group answered, maybe we would ask, we would send a request of ECRIS to each of the member states if, for example, it's a question of terrorism, for example, it's a serious case. But some people thought that it would be not necessary to ask every member state, for example, for burglary, like here in the case. After that, for the Tunisian person, one of the member states replied that he needed the fingerprints to be able to secure the identification and how to proceed with that. Would it be useful to attach the fingerprints to the request, for example, to Belgium, to Spain and Germany, where the Tunisian which the Tunisian was involved with during his life. We concluded that it would be useful to send the fingerprints. At that moment of the discussion inside the group, we mentioned that we have some difference among the member states. We have differences concerning the culture of taking fingerprints. That's different between the member states. In some member states, fingerprints are taken very often. For example, yes, it's more taken, for example, in the countries where, for example, the criminal record is held by the police. We saw this morning with Belgium case, for example, that this is not the case. The criminal record in Belgium is held by the justice, by the justice department. So you see, we saw that there are different cultures concerning the taking of fingerprints. Concerning the second person, the Slovenian, if Slovenia is connected with France, yes, of course, France would ask Slovenia to have more information about convictions. But if Slovenia is not connected with France, the only way to get information about the person is to send a request on paper, which is still the case for some of our countries, which are not yet connected in the ECRI system. Then we raised the question of the connection of the member states inside ECRIS. I can tell you that, as you saw this morning with Jaime, for example, with the table with green and red countries, we can conclude that the connection of the member states happen often via negotiation. I mean that, how is it that, for example, some countries are not yet connected with others, and how will they connect with the others in the future? We see that it's often via negotiation between the states that connection happens. For example, a country which is not yet connected with a lot of others say at the moment, I'm ready to connect. So you see that it's a question of, I would say, general agreement about connection in ECRIS. Then the Italian people born in Roma, he has aliases. So we discussed about the problem of the alias and also the changes of names, because some people, of course, they change officially of name, and does the criminal record store that information? Is it transmitted when there is a request? These are the cases we have to face, for example, with this kind of situations. In some countries, like for example in Belgium, there is an updating of our criminal record concerning the personal data via the National Register of Populations. In some other countries, there is not such an automatic updating. Sorry. So there are differences between the states. So for the French person, it's the last one. Only the French criminal record would be consulted, because we have only information that it's a French people born in France. So the conclusion we had is the next question we have is, if a member state asks for fingerprints of a Tunisian, what do you do? This is really a problem, because a Tunisian, as we saw this morning, and of course it's not a national, a EU national. What do we do with the fingerprints we have? There is still a problem for the moment with that kind of data. So that's it for our case.
I will be relatively brief. We had some very interesting discussions on what I think many people regard as the vital question of recognition and enforcement of orders in our example. We could have continued for at least another hour, I think. And we had a very good representation from, I think, probably at least 10 EU countries. We looked at particular issues such as whether applications could be made in the executing state for any amendment of an order from an issuing state. And it was quite interesting to discuss and find out the different experiences between countries of getting information, investigative information, right at the beginning. So if a Bulgarian judge or prosecutor wanted information from Latvia, how easy it would be to obtain and how quickly it would be to obtain. And it's quite clear that different countries have got different experiences. It would appear that the UK did not come out on top of cooperation, which is a great shame, if that's right. And certainly in my job, which is a relatively new task I've got of cooperation, I will do my best to make sure that these requests are dealt with within months, not years. The question of civil asset recovery, non-conviction based asset recovery, was discussed. I had not appreciated that Bulgaria had it and that other countries either have it or will soon have it. And it's obviously recognised now in the proposed new EU directive that there should be recognition of civil non-conviction based orders. So that's something for the future. But there's no doubt that there are still issues about mutual recognition and mutual enforcement when it comes to innocent, if they are innocent, third parties, as to what representations can they make about an order. And it's a question I posed, and I simply posed it, I didn't give the answer to it. What happens if a Bulgarian judge makes an order freezing a house in Spain, which is in the joint names of a man who's suspected to be a terrorist or a criminal in Bulgaria, but the Bulgarian judge has frozen the house in Spain? And the wife of the suspect says, but hang on, I own half this house. How can you freeze the house? Or to use a better example, a bank account. Because half the money is my money. And I need half this money for me and my children, because he's now in prison in Bulgaria. And I need it. And if I don't have it, I'll starve. And the children will starve. So, what is she to do? The theory, if not the principle, is she has to go to Bulgaria to ask the Bulgarian judge to amend the order. And she says, I can't go to Bulgaria. One, my children are age 1 and 2. 2, I have no money to travel to Bulgaria. 3, I have no money to pay for a Bulgarian judge. Bulgarian lawyer. That was a slight Freudian slip, wasn't it?
They are expensive.
And Bulgarian lawyers are very expensive. There are many jokes about bribing judges when both sides bribe the same judge. What decision does he make? But I have to say, we have never in England, at least not in the last century, by that I mean the previous century, had any suggestion that any judge has been bribed, which is interesting. Anyway, leaving that as a let alone a conviction, there's never been an allegation. So what is she to do? And the Spanish judge says, I'm very sorry, I know you're going to starve, and I know your children are going to starve, and I know you say it's half your money, and I can see that there is evidence that it's half your money, but the Bulgarian judge made the order, and I'm afraid you have to travel to Sofia and apply before the judge. Is that actually correct? Well, the view of delegates was too bad. She has to go to Bulgaria. That was the general view. And I wonder whether that's actually right or not. So these are issues that are going to arise and do arise in these cases. There may be a distinction between a freezing order and a confiscation order, actually taking the money and freezing it. But these are the questions we discuss. And as I say, we could have spent another hour discussing these questions and recognition. But I'm very grateful to all the helpful contributions we received. And I will take back with me the comments made about the UK. Thank you.
We have been discussing about exchange of information. And the first part of the discussion was about our experience related with letter of request. So the Greece prosecutor explained that their experience is to send letter of request through this Minister of Justice, so it's the traditional way, but they have a special prosecutor in terrorism, so they begin to change in this field. Belgium and Portugal, they have really prosecutor and officers, so it's the prosecutor officers that take charge about this letter of request. In Finland, they have underlined three times, so it's important to say that they have this Scandinavian legal system, and they have, for more than 20 years, they have this exchange of information through informal channels. So they send emails, they just ask for information. They don't need to copy, so they don't need to send a request directly to other judicial authorities. And they work with this, and it's really useful. With third countries, it's not like this. They use more formal channels, but it's okay. The Finland prosecutor has asked me, he has asked what happens, because he has explained that they are receiving all these refugees, and they have this question about receiving this large amount of refugees. They don't know if they come from Syria, they are related with Chia, or they don't have this information, and he was asking if we could help them in this field. And so from Eurojust, he underlined, the prosecutor from Austria, I think, he underlined the position that the useful tool that it's the genocide network that can provide this information sometimes. In Spain, I'm sorry, I don't have real experience in, I have experience in letters of request, but when they ask me, We send mutual legal assistance to Spain, and we have these problems because of your territorial distribution, that we have to send, one request to Madrid, but when it affects Malaga or Barcelona, or what can we do if we have to send different mutual legal assistance demands, or we can do it at once. So I suggest, and for sure, my colleagues can say it for sure, that if you have any doubt, just send it or to the national court, because they have, this is the court that takes, that it's in charge of all the terrorist offenses and problems. Or I suggest that we have a very fluent communication with the special prosecutor in international cooperation. All the communication between prosecutors related with international cooperation is really fluent. I mean, it's really easy to get that information. So just go there, or we will be helpful to relocate the question. Bulgaria has underlined also that mutual legal assistance is a top priority. They have a terrorism specialist, and the German prosecutor explained that if you send a mutual legal assistance demand, and you, unless they don't have any jurisdiction about that, they will try also to just send it to the other authorities that can answer your question. then the interesting thing was talking about the joint investigation team. They explained Bell and the French colleague, they explained the importance of the joint investigation team because of Paris attacks. It was really interesting, it was really useful to just have this joint investigation team. It's just like a contract when you say, who is going to take part of that JIT, the means of that JIT, how long is going to last that joint investigation team, and you just can discuss the facts you want to do. So two French police officers could take part of the investigation taking place in Belgium, and we just discussed about the problems you could have related with the using of the evidence. Of course, it's clear that these police can take part on the other investigation, but what happens when you want to use the evidence on the different trials? And they explained that it's something you discuss, because if you have any legal doubts, you just can ask or the judge or the prosecutor that takes part of the tea party. So it's something that you can discuss. We talked about the problems related with the more high legal standards when we talk about taking care of the rights of the arrest people, because in Italy, in the Czech Republic, even in Spain, we have high legal standards, and the answer it is if you're asking for higher legal standards, just ask it. It's no problem. The problem is when you go down the legal standards, not when you go when you pretend to be more guaranteed, to give more guarantee. Talking about the UK, that they don't come on top of cooperation.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's true.
We talked about the JIT related with the case of Madeleine McCain, just talking about the difficulties of these sensible themes. And finally, the conclusion is that we have this tool that is the Article 7, this continuous information, exchange of information, because the German colleague again explained a case of fraud, of 1,000 euros fraud, that it was very simple, but when it came to the economical investigation to the bank accounts, at the end it was like, okay, there's a lot of more people that have been victim of this fraud, and perhaps we could do something. And so the answer was, yes, you can do this spontaneous exchange of information, because the conclusion is that you don't have to leave everything to the police. We as judicial authorities, as judges or prosecutors, we have this informal, useful tool that we have to use it to better our work. That's it.